Supervisors, please take your seats. All right, I will call the meeting to order. We have, I think, 26 members present, and we'll start out with a proclamation on Human Services and Family Court Month. Steve O'Malley. It's also in your packet.
March 2008, Human Services and Family Court Month. Whereas staff who work in the Human Services Department and Family Court of the county literally touch thousands of lives every day who are in need of temporary or longer-term assistance to meet their basic needs or to adjust to transitions in their families. And whereas citizens who rely on county Human Services and Family Court programs range in age from pre-birth to over 100 years of age. And whereas county Human Services programs are designed to protect our most vulnerable populations, which include children, adults, and children with disabilities, the aging, and people dealing with mental illness, and whereas family court mediation and family court services strive to maintain the dignity, safety, and security of families going through difficult transitions, and whereas the individuals and entire community benefit from the investment in lives that Human Services and Family Court professionals make every day, now therefore be it resolved, the La Crosse County Board does hereby proclaim the month of March 2008 as Human Services and Family Court Month and urges all citizens to join in recognizing the valuable contribution of Human Services and Family Court staff.
Moved by Sharon Hampson, second by Jill Billings. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. All right, next we have presentation on the natural step for eco-municipalities, and I'm going to ask Jay Johnson to come forward.
Good evening, and welcome to our guests this evening. In June of 2007, this board voted overwhelmingly to pass a resolution that officially made sustainability a priority for county government and identified the natural step as the model that we would use to help move us in the direction of a more sustainable La Crosse. A lot of work has gone on behind the scenes since that time that you'll be hearing more about in the coming months, but what we'd like to do tonight is to begin to talk in greater detail about that natural step model. One of the advantages of choosing a specific model as we have is it enables us to develop a common language and a common understanding so we can better communicate about some of these complex issues and decisions. Another advantage with the natural step is that it's not new. It actually started in Sweden 25 years ago, so it's being implemented around the world very successfully. It's been especially widely adopted here in Wisconsin. I like to think that's because we're a little bit smarter here in Wisconsin, but that's just me. But one advantage that gives us is there are many examples of how this has been applied to benefit communities and local governments that you'll hear more about shortly. And I think that can help all of us form a clearer picture of just what that resolution, that eco-designation, can mean for the future of the County of La Crosse. Toward that end, with us tonight is Lisa McKinnon. Ms. McKinnon was policy director for 1,000 Friends of Wisconsin for 9 years. She's co-founder and coordinator of the North American Eco-Municipality Network. She's been instrumental in organizing tours of Sweden, where people have gone to Sweden to see some of the work, the remarkable work that's being done in that country. She's presented on this topic here and in Europe. Her experience working with eco-municipalities is extensive, and her level of expertise with the natural step is virtually unmatched. I'm very pleased on behalf of the Joint Oversight Committee on Sustainability to introduce Ms. Lisa McKinnon.
Thank you, Jay, for the nice introduction, and thank all of you for being here tonight and giving me the opportunity to talk with you and share with you a little bit about the Natural Step Sustainability Framework and its use in sustainable community development, as well as a little bit about what's going on here in communities. And also, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to get out of Madison and drive here through your beautiful valley. It was a gorgeous day coming up here, and it almost felt like spring. So thank you for that as well. Let's see. Okay, here we go. I know, just what you want to look at with the winter we've had. Actually, I think this was taken in the Mississippi just last week. What this means here, what is sustainability? Sustainability is like an iceberg, I think, for us, in the sense that most of us know something about it. We have a sense of the surface. There's a lot of talk going on, a lot of terminology being thrown around, tossed around these days more and more. But there's also a lot going on beneath the surface. And there are a lot of different definitions that we're hearing, many, many definitions out there to try to help us understand what's going on. What does it mean to be sustainable? What does it mean when people say we're not sustainable right now in our communities, in our planet? And one of them is one that's very common. Probably many of you have seen this. It's from the 1987 Brundtland Report, also known as a report called Our Common Future, which provided a key statement on sustainability and said that economic development must change course to fit within the planet's ecological limits. There are other definitions, and they're all kind of based on various themes. This one's about being able to sustain the livelihood of people around the world who depend on our system, the ecosystem, for an indefinite period. Many of you have probably heard the term carrying capacity. Oops. How did that happen? Carrying capacity. And then natural capital also. These are all themes of sustainability that are discussed when people start talking about this topic. And one thing that they all have in common, despite their varying themes, is that the idea that the permanence and health of our economic and our social systems are absolutely dependent upon the vitality and the proper functioning of our ecological systems. So you have economy and society in this case. There are a lot of graphic illustrations of sustainability, but this one really is speaking to the fact that the economy and the society are contained within our ecosystem, our ecological system, and are really limited by the limits of our environment and of our ecosystem. And you already recognize this as a body because, as Jay referenced, you overwhelmingly passed a resolution almost a year ago now to adopt a goal to become more sustainable as a county, and you acknowledged in the very first clause that a clean and healthy environment determines the quality of life, where the environment can support and sustain the community, and where the citizens are committed to local and regional cooperation and a personal philosophy of stewardship to be able to ensure that this works out here. And for those of you who like sports metaphors, this is another way to put it. Nature truly does bat last. The problem is we've got all these definitions, we have all of these graphic illustrations, but it's still very difficult for local governments to then take those and translate those into action, into planning, into strategy. And so you've got your resolutions and you've got your definitions and you've got lots and lots of talk about sustainability, but I think a number of us who work in local government or work with local governments stand about and say, you know, we know we should do something, we know this is an issue, but how do we proceed? And when we do, how do we know we're going in the right direction? So back to the iceberg. I think some of you are probably here. You're taking the leap. You've got the Joint Oversight Committee. You've got a number of people who are diving in. And then there are others up here. You've got some folks in the city, and you've got some of you sitting in the room tonight who are thinking about it, who may be considering it, and others who are saying, you know, I'm still not sure what this is about. And do I want to go left? Do I want to go right? Do I want to just stay where I am, stay comfortable? It's pretty cozy up here. And so essentially the question becomes, what does all this sustainability stuff mean for your community, for your county, for the broader community? And so what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about, go a little bit deeper into the natural step. You've already adopted this as a framework or endorsed these principles as a body, but there are some deeper ways of looking at it and some things to look at in terms of what it means for a local government structure, for a county structure, and local government jurisdictions. The natural step is both a sustainability framework. It's also an international non-governmental organization, which, as Jay mentioned, has been around for about 25 years. It was established in Sweden initially as a nonprofit by a Swedish pediatric oncologist named Carl Henrik Robert. And I should just mention at this point, Dr. Robert is actually coming to Wisconsin. He will be here in almost exactly a month. He's going to be visiting Madison for 3 days, and there will be a number of opportunities to hear him. He's speaking in the Distinguished Lecture Series. And so if you're interested in that, I'd be happy to give you more information about that. He's a wonderful, inspiring speaker. What he was troubled by in his work in scientific research and cancer research were some of the environmental connections, but what really caught his attention was that whether it was within the scientific community or the political community, his home community, people who were making decisions on the local level, people often got caught in the debate about details. And he thought that surely the scientific community could play a more strategic or constructive role in getting people to pull back a little bit from getting mired in the details and try to see if there were some basic scientific principles that everyone could agree on when it came to the issue of sustainability. And so what he did is he initiated a consensus process with the international scientific community, and they worked through 10, 20, 22 different iterations. They worked together to develop a science and systems-based definition of sustainability. And then they turned to translating their work into a framework that could be used by businesses and organizations and communities to assist them in their planning and thinking strategically based on these science-based principles. And so I mentioned systems thinking, and this is a good place to start when we're talking about understanding sustainability. A system, as most of you know, is a whole that consists of, you know, two or more parts. And all the parts of the system are interrelated and interdependent. And if we remove or manipulate from outside the system any one of these parts, all of the other parts, the overall character of the system, will be affected in some way. And when we're talking about sustainability, everyone thinks of the planet, the big blue marble there. But we have all sorts of complex systems. That's kind of the giant system on top of everything else. But certainly you all know how complex running a county government is and answering to your constituency and providing the services and all of the many responsibilities that you carry out as county board officials. The county board is a very complex system. The city government's a complex system. Our larger community, which encompasses more than just these formal jurisdictions, is a very complex system with all of the social and economic and ecological parts moving together. And usually, traditionally, what we do is we try to understand systems by looking at these individual parts, because it's easier, you know, to pull something out and say, this is going to be my niche, this is going to be what I'm going to really focus on and become an expert in. And this is known as reductionism or compartmentalizing, and it's something that is a necessary thing to do in a lot of cases. But we also know that systems being what they are, the properties of systems depend on interrelationships, on how one moving part over here connects with the other. If you think about a watch and the moving parts of a watch, you know, put your digital aside for a second and think about, you know, traditional mechanics, and each of those parts has an interaction with the other. And when you dissect the system, you change the pattern of those relationships. And a good metaphor for a system is the tree over there on the right. You've got the branches and the trunks, and those are really the basic principles of the system. That's where the water comes up through from the ground. The branches really hold the leaves and the structure and form the skeleton of the tree. And the leaves and smaller limbs are more the detail level of the system. And individuals, each one of us is really ingenious when it comes to dealing in this way with systems. When we learn a new language, when we learn to drive or to ride a bike or to play an instrument, we take all of those moving parts and coordinate them and are able to, you know, to put that all together and make it work. But what happens when we get into large groups like this is the group becomes often dumber than the least intelligent individual in the room, because they're no longer able to do this. They start focusing on their particular niche, on their particular drill hole, as we call it. And what happens is the rules of the system go out the window, and everybody starts thinking about specific areas. And you have a difficulty moving the system forward as a working, progressing thing. And so another way to look at this is drill holes, which is something Karl-Henrik Robert talks about. In an organization like this, in scientific organizations, everybody has a specialty that they really focus on. And they drill deeper and deeper and get a greater and greater expertise in that particular area. In this case, you know, your department, your particular agency. And so you increase knowledge, but you have very limited or even no understanding of what's going on in those other drill holes, in those other agencies and other departments in many cases. And this isn't a valuable societal model for sustainable development. And the reason is because many times, and I'm sure you have experienced this more than once, you may all think you've got one goal. You know, you've got a resolution that you've passed, and you've decided you're going to do something. There's a mandate, and people have decided on it. But you go off to your different areas, or the mandate falls down to the various agencies or departments within the county. And where it starts out as an individual goal, people think they're all working on the same goal, and they get back together, and they realize they've been working at cross purposes in many cases. You know, somebody's implementing the goal over here, and what they've done negatively affects what somebody over here was doing, thinking they were implementing the very same goal. So one way to get out of this is to try to make connections between those areas, so taking a structured overview and creating a shared understanding of the system, getting out of those drill holes a little bit, crossing over agencies and departments, and working toward the same goal and actually strengthening your understanding of the whole system because you're doing that. And the funnel, how many of you are familiar with this metaphor for unsustainability? Was there a discussion of that when you talked about the natural step? Okay. This is one of the metaphors for our current challenge, our current reality on the planet, in our individual communities, that the natural step uses. And what we're seeing is we have rapidly increasing population, affluence, despite the economic downturn we're hearing about every day in the morning radio, technology, and global trade. And all of these things have led to a couple centuries of astonishing material abundance, really a level of abundance and a level of quality of life that would have been inconceivable even a couple hundred years ago. What that's also led to is an increasing demand for many of our natural resources and ecosystem services. And so the other side of this funnel, we see water, soil, forests, biodiversity, various species facing increasing pressure based on the increase in all of these, the population affluence, consumption levels. And those resources and ecosystem services are actually in decline because the demand on them is so high. And when I talk about ecosystem services, I'm talking about things like water infiltration. I'm talking about flood control, the plant systems that clean our air, that provide for our healthy topsoils and things like that. All of the things that nature provides free of charge to us that keep life going. And it doesn't take a genius to see what happens when the walls of the funnel converge. You've got a serious conflict. And a closing margin for action. And again, this is something that's not going to be new to any of you. The implications for communities of this paradigm, of this current situation where we are, as a planet, as various communities, using more than we actually have, or that the planet or ecosystems can replenish, has serious risks and serious costs for us on the community level. Every organization and community in the world demonstrates its grasp of this by either moving in a direction of trying to do something or just ignoring it. And for those who are ignoring the problem, they're going to see increasing operational costs, and that's everything: water, energy, waste disposal, infrastructure, maintenance, and that's a big issue right now. Everywhere I go, every conference I go to, whether it's on the federal level or down to the community, local community level, there's a very serious concern with our infrastructure and how it's aging and how are we going to replace it in order to maintain safety and provide the services people have come to expect. Increased demand for social services because of this metaphor. Regulation and compliance challenges are coming up. People are concerned about being on the wrong side of the law on the local level and the cost that that's going to entail, and the extra time, not just financial costs, but human resource costs. And And that's why it's so important, and I think that's one of the reasons that I'm seeing many communities around Wisconsin and around the world starting to really take these issues seriously, is that they're seeing that if they invest in sustainability now, they have an opportunity to start meeting these challenges. The longer they wait to plan for change, the more constraints they're going to face over time and the fewer options they're going to have in terms of meeting these challenges. But it's not all about avoiding catastrophe. There are actually many very positive opportunities to be had by dealing directly and straightforwardly with the issues of sustainability. We're seeing communities that are turning this into opportunities for economic development, turning this into opportunities for individuals who have never been that involved with the community to really engage and to participate. So there are opportunities to be had that are positive. And I want to talk just a little bit about the science of sustainability and of the natural step. We've got a basic understanding of unsustainability of our current situation, but we need to take a step back and understand at the basic principle level what the conditions are for a sustainable society. In other words, what do we need to do to get out of this funnel? And not just get out of it to stabilize it, but maybe even have some restoration in our natural system so that you might even see in the future the sides of the funnel opening back out again. You know, there's a possibility in some cases for that to occur. But it also needs requires an understanding of the basic principles and science behind it. So what can scientists tell us? We've got a tree and our cow. And I'm going to try to go through this. I don't usually go through lectures on thermodynamics, and don't be afraid, I'm not going to do that tonight, but I think it's important to have some of the basics. On the planet, there are generally two main life forms, plants and animals. And I say generally because if I say absolutely, then someone will inevitably raise their hand and say, what about bacteria or mushrooms? So generally, plants and animals. And there's an elegant relationship between these two. The plants produce the oxygen and the food for the animals, which they eat. And the animal, very kindly in turn, provides the carbon dioxide and the organic waste that the plants need to use as nutrients. In addition, when the plant or when the animal dies, it also provides yet a further source of food. And that's also the crux of the basic science behind this, is that waste is food. And that's something that if communities would just get back to that concept alone, we would see an incredible decrease in the amount of waste that we produce, in the costs that we incur as communities and as a planet to dispose of that waste and to try to deal with it. That issue alone would be incredible, and I think communities are starting to address that. Another thing the scientists agree about is that the Earth is a closed system with respect to matter. And here's where the thermodynamics come in. First, nothing disappears. This is the first law of thermodynamics, which means that matter, the matter that has always existed on the Earth still exists. It's just in different forms. And you know this intuitively. When you fill up your gas tank and you drive it for a while and it's back on empty, it didn't disappear, did it? I mean, your money disappeared, and disappearing more and more frequently or more quickly. But it just changed form. It went from gas in a liquid form to pollutants and carbon and other greenhouse gas emissions in another form. So it's still with us. It's just a different form of matter. The second law of science that we're dealing with, that scientists can agree upon, is that everything disperses, and that's the second law of thermodynamics. And in this case, think about things like cars rust, carpets turn to dust, ink when you drop it in a bucket of water. It doesn't disappear. Its molecules are still there, but they've dispersed. Pretty basic stuff that we all take for granted. We don't always think about it in these terms every day. We just take it for granted. But this sets up an interesting question. If matter on the planet is finite and everything is gradually breaking down, then why aren't we just in one big mucky mess and chaos, you know, abounding everywhere? And instead, what we're seeing is the exact opposite. Over billions of years, the planet has flourished and has actually become this beautiful place. And that is due to the fact that with respect to energy, the planet is an open system. So energy comes in from the sun, and it is let back out as radiation energy. And what that does is fuels the process, fuels the living things on the planet, the plants in this case, through photosynthesis. And photosynthesis is what gives us all of those free services, all of those ecological services in many cases, allows our food to grow, uses the sun energy. It's the only thing that can use the sun energy from outside of the system. And in contrast to these fast sun-driven cycles, we also have slow geological cycles where materials from the Earth's crust come out and go back in through sedimentation over a very, very long period of time. And because it's such a slow geological cycle, the Earth has managed to process them, metabolize those various metals and minerals for, you know, over millennia, and is able to do that as a part of the process very well. And of course, the system wouldn't be complete without humans. We're inherently a part of the system. We're entirely dependent upon nature's systems and upon each other, upon the social and the cultural systems that we've created. And so sustainability is essentially about ability of all these cycles to run forever, to run permanently, indefinitely, without barriers, without breaking down. And so if this is sustainability, why do we see problems today? The problem is that there are all sorts of mechanisms for unsustainability, things that we do on a daily basis, on a minute-by-minute basis, to disrupt the cycles that I just talked about. And we're disrupting the cycles basically in four ways. The first way is that we are systematically increasing concentrations of matter that we take from the Earth's crust. So in this case, we're digging up material from the Earth's crust, and we're introducing it into nature faster than nature can process it, and redepositing it back into nature's cycles faster than nature is accustomed to processing it. So this results in increasing concentrations. Examples of this are increasing concentrations of carbon leading to climate change, increasing concentrations of sulfur leading to acid rain, the concentrations of heavy metals like mercury and calcium that we're seeing in human kidneys. I like to tell this story because it's remarkable to me. Up in Ashland, which is another one of the communities that have adopted this framework, they're one of the first communities in the state of Wisconsin a couple years ago to adopt this. And they had some pretty robust discussions about whether they wanted to do this on the community level. And one of the individuals who everyone assumed would say, no, this is, you know, we're not going to do this. This is something we don't need to deal with. We don't need to adopt this. He actually was one of the key proponents of it. And the reason was he's up in Lake Superior. He has, across his lifetime, fished and swam and lived off of the lake. And he went to the doctors shortly before they took up this issue and found out that he has the second highest level of mercury in his blood in the state, and it is directly attributable to eating the fish of Lake Superior. And he wants to be able to continue to eat the fish of Lake Superior. His doctors told him don't, but he was, you know, he recognized that these systems were being broken down. The second way that we break up the system, break the cycle, is that we create a systematic increase in concentration of substances produced by society. We produce long, complex chains of molecules, and we use them in our products and our processes, and then allow them to disperse back into nature, and they break down as a part of that entropy process, and they stay in the ecological system. And they increase in concentration at some point. And it's not just about toxic chemicals, although that's certainly an issue. It's about things that aren't necessarily toxic. Water is not something we associate with being toxic, but at a certain level of concentration, even water can become a toxic compound. And so it's about loading up the system beyond a point that it can bear, beyond a point that it can metabolize or process. And the third way we break these cycles is in systematically deteriorating our physical environment. We inhibit the ability of nature by doing this, by running these sun-driven cycles, by proceeding with photosynthesis, by manipulating nature in a way that it can't recover from. This is where we tend to talk about traditional environmental degradation, like deforestation, like overfishing, like destroying habitats that then destroy biodiversity. Working where I worked in land use and transportation for many years, I always think about sprawl development and paving over our very, very valuable topsoil and paving over areas that have historically served as groundwater recharge or flood control. All of those things disrupt the system. And finally, the fourth way that we break the cycle is that in doing these other things and in carrying out policies on the government level, on the individual level, we put up barriers to people meeting their basic human needs. And the conception of human needs here is certainly subsistence, things like food, water, shelter, clothing, a job. But it's also about other things, the ability to participate in your community, the ability to be creative, the ability to experience tolerance, to experience affection, the ability to be a part of something larger, the ability to work. So it's a very broad conception of human needs. And the traditional paradigm for this that people talk about and have talked about for a long time is the rainforest, deforestation of the rainforest. If an individual has no other way to feed his or her family but to cut down the trees that happen to be on the land that they own, and that is their choice, they're going to choose to feed their family, and the ecological side effects of that are going to be a luxury that they don't have to deal with. And so we need to find ways as communities to make sure that we're addressing whether we're putting up barriers to people's basic needs when we're making decisions and taking actions. And so to define sustainability, we take those mechanisms and we say, we can't be doing that. If those are the things that break the cycle, we need to stop that. So how do we do that? And the four system conditions or sustainability principles that the Natural Step uses are directly from those scientific principles, the first being that in a sustainable society, nature is not going to be subject to systematically increasing concentrations of substances extracted from the earth. And the way to deal with that, the way to get to that principle or to have that achieve that characteristic is to go from inefficient use to efficient use of the things that we take from the earth, to go from a dissipative use to using tight technical cycles. So when we're talking about metals or we're talking about minerals, certainly things like fossil fuels, we need to start thinking about not just letting them, you know, supposedly evaporate into the atmosphere, but finding a way to keep them over and over again, to be able to use them over and over again. Recycling is an obvious example here. And then going from using scarce materials to more abundant materials so that those generations we talked about in the early definition have some access, have some use down the road of some of these more abundant materials. And then fossil fuels to renewables is kind of a no-brainer at this point, I think. The second principle, in a sustainable society, nature is not going to be subject to systematically increasing concentrations of substances produced by society. And I think I talked about the toxic and non-toxic. Again, we need to go from inefficient use of these things to efficient use, move away from using and producing persistent and unnatural compounds to using things that are abundant or producing things that break down easily. And I have this chart up here. I don't know if you can see it, but there are various chemical compounds. And what that represents is that in our society right now, we produce over 70,000 known synthetic chemical compounds. So that's just a tiny list. And we do these commercially, and many of these are persistent, which means that they don't naturally break down in through the Earth's cycles right now, either because they haven't been around long enough for natural systems to, you know, evolve to figure out how to do that. They can't be easily metabolized by the system. And this gets to the physical degradation issue. We can't continue to subject nature to increasing degradation by physical means, and that's all of the things that I mentioned before. So when we're looking at ways to meet this trait, to satisfy this principle of sustainability, we need to think about using our resources more efficiently, whether it's land, whether it's water, whether it's forest products, all of those things. There are ways to use them more and less efficiently. And then also thinking about how we manage resources. And in a state like Wisconsin, which has a very robust forestry economy and relies very heavily on its forest products to provide economic stability, you need to think in terms of how do you manage those for maximum sustainability so that we have access to them, so that the natural systems aren't destroyed, so that those natural systems continue to provide not just all of the ecological services but the economic services to the state and to, you know, the states and the world beyond. And then finally, that fourth condition, the social. In order to achieve the first three, those first three characteristics, we really do need to pay attention to the social realm and not systematically undermine the ability of people to meet their needs. This principle has been stated in other ways as meeting needs worldwide. And that language was changed somewhere along the line. And I think the recognition was that that local governments have a responsibility to individuals. Organizations have a responsibility to the people inside their organization, as well as the people who they're serving, their customers, their clients, whatever. But the very basic responsibility they have is to not get in the way of those people meeting their basic needs. They may not be able to meet every single need of every single person, every single resident in this county, but certainly being able to examine your policies and your operations and your management for signs of, you know, putting roadblocks in the way of people's needs is something that you can do and have a responsibility to do. So that deals with things like working and living environments and economic barriers and the ability to make a livelihood, political involvement, the ability to participate freely and independently in society. And so usually what happens is that when people talk to crowds about the natural step, they stop here. And many people understand the natural step as a set of four principles and say, that's good, that makes sense, the science makes sense to me. I can deal with that, I can think about those things when I'm making decisions. But what I want to do is go further. The natural step is actually, it identifies those principles, those basic conditions, but it also identifies a way to view and apply those principles on an organizational, on a community, on a business level, so that you can plan and act for sustainability. You have the principles in your back pocket, you pull them out when you're making decisions, but there's also a strategic process that I think can be very helpful, on certainly on the community level. And the process is the ABCD process. The four sustainability principles define success as far as sustainability is concerned, but each community has to draw its own conclusions about how it's going to implement those principles, how it's going to translate those principles for your community, for your county, given your resources, your challenges, your demographics, all of that. And so you have to figure out what your problems are, what problems you have, what are the solutions, you know, no easy task, and then what actions are needed to implement those solutions. And the ABCD process provides a systematic way of doing this. And the process, the Natural Step Framework calls it backcasting, and it's really beginning with the end in mind. And again, you're all geniuses out there when it comes to this. People make decisions based on some solid understanding of where they're trying to go. But again, what happens in groups is that we kind of forget it. We have an end in mind. We don't necessarily connect it to principles. The best description I've heard of this is somebody saying, well, I was born in Mexico, and I went to school in Arizona, and I've been living in Madison, so I guess I'll probably be living in Alaska next, with no discussion of why they're going to live in Alaska. Is there a job in Alaska? Is there a school in Alaska? Are their needs going to be met in Alaska? What we often do is we tend to rely more on forecasting. And so, you know, that model is kind of a forecasting model. This is where I've been, so I guess I'm going this way. And we use that a lot in local governments, and it's a useful tool in many cases for planning on kind of the micro level. I've been very frustrated in many cases sitting on MPOs and regional plan commissions where we talk very much about the trends and the current demographic data, and we start making decisions based on those, and yet those are precisely the facts that have led to the problems and the snafus we're trying to get out of in those meetings. And so it's a bit ironic. Forecasting is useful in certain circumstances, but if we're trying to correct things that have come from the past trends and the past decision-making, we can't be using the old tools. And so backcasting suggests that we start with success in mind. And in this case, success is the principles, are the principles of sustainability, if you're talking about trying to go in a sustainable direction. And one of the metaphors that I think is useful, and my disclaimer here, I do not play chess, but I do know that in chess, success is checkmate. And so that's the principle in chess, just like the four system conditions or four sustainability principles are the rules of the game for sustainability. And you can play chess 100 different ways. You can use a different strategy every time, and it's going to necessarily change every time because, depending on your partner, they're a moving target as well. You're going to have to respond to different moves that he or she makes, and so you're going to need to be flexible. But if you keep the rules of the game in mind, checkmate, getting your partner's king to not be able to move, and so that you can win, you're going to be able to get there eventually. And that's kind of the principle of backcasting. And these checkmate's a first-order principle, which means it's the ultimate definition of success. And all the other details that are involved in the system, how to move the pieces, strategies, those are all secondary details that you work out as after you've understood the principles. I think we've already covered this. What are the principles of success for sustainability? We've talked about those. And so this gets put into practice through a planning process that some people call the ABCD process, and it's just an acronym for awareness, baseline analysis, compelling vision, and down to action. And the A step is something that you've already been engaged in. I know you've had other people come and talk to you. Mary Raywald was here about a year ago. The Joint Oversight Committee has been meeting and discussing issues of sustainability. And so that's really the teaching and the education piece of sustainability and starting to create the shared language and shared understanding. And it's also about making sure that the participants that are walking down this road together are agreeing somewhat on the objective study, agreeing on the challenge ahead of you, that funnel, the issue of unsustainability that we talked about earlier, and then also a future landing spot. In other words, you agree that those principles, that definition of success for sustainability, is where you want to land eventually as a community. B is for baseline analysis, and I know that you're also engaged in that. I was talking to Jay a little bit about what the joint committee is doing, and she said that there's discussion of indicators and baseline analysis, and that's something that we do on the community level all the time with respect to planning and working in government on a lot of different levels. How am I doing for time? Just wondering. Okay. And this involves doing an assessment of how your community is currently contributing to breaking those cycles, how you're currently violating it. And it's not about assessing or assigning blame, because every single community is failing on this count. Every single community, every single organization, every single individual is not a pristine, perfect citizen when it comes to those principles. Everybody's breaking those rules in some way. So it's not about assigning blame. It's about getting a realistic understanding of where you are, of the material and energy flows created by your community, and how they contribute to sustainability or unsustainability, so that you can decide what you need to work on. And this same type of questioning is used to assess new product development. It's used to assess success and progress in departments and agencies. It's also very useful to focus on a specific area like food or energy systems, arts and culture, whatever. So it's applicable widely. And then the compelling vision is something that you do next. And it doesn't exactly look linear on this slide, but ABCD, we think in linear terms, and so I just want to make it clear that this is really a cyclical process. Awareness is always happening. You're learning more and more. You're getting together. There's feedback from different agencies and departments, so awareness is always something that's happening, just as the baseline analysis is something that's always being built on. And the compelling vision is, this is a creative step that involves envisioning the characteristics of what your community is going to look like in a sustainable future. How could you provide your community services in a better way so that you're meeting those principles, satisfying those principles of sustainability? And at this point in the process, you're not supposed to be so worried about economic feasibility or political feasibility. Really be bold. Throw all the ideas out there, even the cockamamie ones, even the ones that you know are going to be shot down, they're going to go down in flames. Throw those out there and be creative and think about you know, what does this mean? Maybe that's not going to work right now. That part of the compelling vision is dead in the water. But somewhere down the line, after you've made some success, who knows? But put it all out there. It's a brainstorming exercise. Oops. And then the final piece of it is getting down to action. And this is actually the piece that everyone seems to want to get to first. Let's just, you know, okay, I understand sustainability. What can we do? What are the projects? What are the initiatives? And I understand the, you know, the compelling nature of getting down to action, but I think it's really important to go through these other processes because they will really inform which actions you take. And the action is where you start to chart out from your current reality where you need to go, and it involves prioritizing based on, is this the right direction? You know, whether it's a policy or a small action or a large initiative, is it the right direction to go? And that means, is it going to satisfy these principles? Is it providing a flexible platform? And that means that it's acknowledging that no single action is going to create a sustainable La Crosse County. It's going to be a process of things building on each other. So you want to pick the ones that are going to get you the farthest, that are also going to leave you open for some flexibility, particularly when you're thinking about technologies. And there are lots of stories about this where communities are doing this analysis. And there is a technology that exists right now on one or another issue that would really put them in a great position, but it would cost so much money and commit them to using that technology out into the far future that it doesn't really provide them with the opportunity to be flexible if things change and they have an opportunity to do something even better. So thinking strategically. And then finally, does it provide a return on investment so that you can get some early successes, economic and political, and be able to feed those back into the process? And just to give you a couple examples, one of the things that communities that I've worked with have done is they've used, when they're doing kind of homework on this, they've used transportation, their transportation system, as one of the areas or one of the agencies that they like to do baseline, a current reality assessment, because it's so rich with opportunities for violating the principles that we've talked about earlier. And also many communities are starting to do positive things about the transportation system. So there's a real balance. They've got some things that they need to work on. They've also got some examples to point to where they're actually making progress. And so they ask themselves the question, you know, how's our transportation system contributing to all of these, you know, these four principles being violated? And then when they're discussing their transportation in terms of creating a compelling vision, they say, okay, if in a sustainable future our transportation system isn't violating these four system conditions or these four principles, then what does it look like? What are its main characteristics? And that's where they ask these questions. And I've gone through this process with a number of community groups and a number of individual local governments, and it's amazing what they come up with. I mean, pages and pages of ideas. And as you'll see in a few minutes, they're implementing a number of their ideas now. So just to finish up, what's happening in Wisconsin? Jay mentioned that there's kind of a little bit of a movement here in the state, and I would agree with that. There are communities around the world that know this framework, that are interested in it, but in the U.S., Wisconsin's really on the vanguard, or in the vanguard when it comes to this particular model, the eco-municipality model using the natural step. And this map represents communities that have formally adopted resolutions that either endorse or adopt the Natural Step sustainability framework, but there are many, many more communities in Wisconsin that are having study circles surrounding the Natural Step that have not committed formally via resolution, but that have formed sustainability committees like your Joint Oversight Committee that are looking at this, looking at the feasibility of it, looking at how they can apply it to their community operations, both internally on the formal government level as well as, you know, involving the broader community in education implementation. And I'll just point out a couple things. The city of Beloit is kind of a more recent adopter of the resolution that endorsed this framework, and they're already looking at creating a template that they'll use in every single city council meeting when they are making decisions, taking votes on various issues, that they will visit those principles and determine as a part of their council process how that fits with those principles. So that's one thing they're doing. Their Chamber of Commerce has also become involved with this and are working both with the city and with local government, or not local government, but local community organizations, and are exploring the possibility of creating a sister city relationship with the Swedish eco-municipality so that they can learn from each other and kind of use them as a mentor. And I think you've heard from Mary Raywald and others in the past about what the Shawmagon Bay communities are doing. They're doing a much more grassroots, bottom-up approach to this. All of their communities have formally adopted, Superior hasn't, but that pod of communities has adopted formal resolutions, but they're also working with the local university and Northland College. They're working with tribal governments who haven't formally adopted but who are very much interested in implementing these ideas, and so are doing a lot of things on the community, local community level. And then I just want to talk a little bit, because I think it's one thing I like to leave you with is that, again, that it's not just these four principles, the language, but it's also the process. I've been very deeply involved with the City of Madison's adoption of the Natural Step framework, December 2005, and I've been kind of a coach of the process and part of an ad hoc steering team, so I've been really very involved on the detail level on this, and I see a number of things that I think have led to their being able to move forward and make progress. They were trained as a city in the fall of, I want to say, 2006, and they trained 24 staff members across agencies and departments. The planning department was represented by a number of people, housing, civil rights division. You can see the fire chief, Deb Amesqua, down in the bottom right. And so there was a good representation across departments and agencies, and it was a multi-month training. The Natural Step Canada came and did it, and it cost money. It was an investment. There was a committee, a sustainable design and energy committee that the mayor had appointed a couple of years before, and they had a little bit of budget to put toward it. They went through the training. I went through it with them, as did a number of other people in the community, and they learned all the stuff that I've talked about today, but they went into it in great depth, and they did a lot of homework and exercises. And one of the things that they did as a part of the training is that they broke up into trios of staff, and they weren't colleagues in departments. They had to work across departments and across agencies so that they could get out of their drill holes and see how what they're doing in their departments affects the work and the challenges and the goals of those and other departments that may or may not be very related. And so that, I'd say that was one of the very best things that came out of this whole process, was that they worked together and across departments in a way that the city hadn't done before, and they've kept that model since the training was over. And they're really calling each other up during the day and saying, hey, I had this idea. Do you guys do anything like this over here, and could we create a project out of it using the Natural Step principles? A couple of other things that came out of this was the mayor decided that the city needed a sustainability manager to deal with these issues and try to kind of comprehensively pull them together. And so there is a city sustainability manager. She's housed out of engineering, so she's really a facilities and sustainability manager. Her name's Jean Hoffman. She's one of the members of this ad hoc TNS, or Natural Step Planning and Steering Team. The other thing, is the top of the list there, is that a planning and steering team was created, and that's been really critical, because I can't emphasize how much of a commitment this is. It's a commitment to making some changes in the way you've done things as an institution in the past. And it can be time-consuming, because you're meeting with your colleagues across departments. And one of the things that's also been important is that the mayor has made it a very specific priority of his. He comes to every other meeting. We have monthly meetings of the whole with the staff that have been trained, and it was that initial 25. But now, over the last year and a half, some of those people who were in the initial training, someone from organizational and HR, have taken it upon themselves to now train other staff. And so we're up to about 150 people in the next couple months being trained, at least in the basics of the Natural Step, again, getting that common language and that shared understanding of what the sustainability goals are for the city. So that's been important. And the mayor, like I said, has, I think it's been critical that there's been executive support during budget discussions. we were having meetings. I shouldn't say we, the city, the council were having meetings until 5 in the morning some nights. And the mayor was at those, of course. And then a couple of times we had our meeting of the whole. And the mayor showed up, you know, with his coffee, not too happy about it, but he was there. And I'll tell you, he really scolded the staff members who weren't there that day. Okay, I haven't slept. I've got my coffee, but I was at the meeting. And, you know, he has shown in a number of ways a level of commitment that's made a difference, I think, to the staff staying committed to it. The other thing is that we have something called a project charter. In addition to the monthly meetings, one thing that was generated from the initial training was a list of initial pilot projects. At the second big training, which is the final day and a half training in this, the trios that had broken up and done homework together on these issues came together as a group and generated about 45 or 50 different ideas of things they're working on in their projects, either in their departments, either in existing projects, projects that are kind of in the pipeline, random ideas, and put a big list together. And then what they did is they, again, worked across departments, and people said, I'd work with this on you, or, you know, this looks good. This is something that might have an application in my agency. I'll work with this on you, even though it's not something that I'm going to do, you know, individually in my agency right now. That big, long list was taken to the mayor, and he kind of helped the staff to pare it down to 10. And these were the 10 projects that came out of that first training. And so each one of these has a number of staff who have been trained in the natural step working on them and applying the principles and the process to them. And some of them are very short-term, narrowly focused. Others are long-term and are going to be big projects. That was 2007, the community or the growing group of city trainees has since generated another list of about 12 in the last few months at meetings. And I mentioned the project charter. I didn't put a slide up because it's very difficult to read up there. I tried that before and it was just a very ugly white space. But I have one here. And what it is it's got a number of purposes, recognizing that these people have taken on a commitment to do this in the community, and the mayor's behind them, and their department heads and their managers are behind them in most cases. They needed a way to communicate to those managers and those department heads and other staff that aren't very intimately engaged with this to communicate what's going on. And so we created this charter, which talks about the project, has an executive sponsor, has a project manager, and describes the work, and then makes a business case or statement of need for the project. But what is most useful, I think, in terms of institutionalizing some of this is that in addition to giving, you know, it's basically like almost like a work order, but what it does is it includes the sustainability principles and the strategic thinking that they're trying to do when they're making decisions. And so it asks, does this project move the city towards sustainability? And then it has the four principles or system conditions, and they need to address how the project is going to do that, whether there are any trade-offs involved. And, you know, it doesn't have to satisfy everyone, but it's just getting them to think. And then it asks, does the project provide a stepping stone towards sustainability? Again, is this something that's going to gain us some ground in reaching our goals and in satisfying those principles? And then finally, it asks whether the project provides a sufficient return to seed future investments. This is where, you know, they do some of that analysis, and they may decide, yes, it does, or they may decide this is something that's going to be like the third rail right now in the city, and we need to put it aside because it's going to either take a lot of our time, or it's not going to lead to opportunities to increase sustainability efforts. And then it goes through, you know, it lists teams. But this has been a very, you know, as pedestrian as it is, it's been a very, very useful tool in helping the staff to communicate with each other, to communicate with managers and department heads, and also to keep the analysis in the forefront of their minds when they're doing these projects. And so just briefly, a couple of the projects, and I mentioned low-hanging fruit, the things that aren't the big, giant capital projects, that aren't the big political red lights, but that get the city going in a direction. And this was one of them. This was one that, was one of the mayor's favorite projects initially. It's the Metro, Madison Metro is our bus, our public transit system in Madison. And it's housed in one big box on East Washington Avenue. Very big facility. And one of the people who trained was a Madison Metro staff administrator. And she said, you know, it's weird, but we have this big box and we have people doing dispatch and we have people doing maintenance and mechanic work, and then we have the bus drivers coming in and out with the buses. And the door opens up innumerable times every day. And in the winter, you think about the energy that's going out. There's no divider between the door where the buses came in and out and where everyone else was working, including the mechanics and the people working at desks and administrative positions. So she said, why don't we put a door in? You know, and people talk about an aha moment, and I call this the duh moment of the training, because it really was pretty basic. And so they already got that in the budget. It's going to cost about $75,000, because this is not a little door, and installation is going to be done by union labor and all of that. But what's interesting to see is that in terms of the purpose of this particular project, it satisfies a number of the principles. It will reduce natural gas use, because they're going to be letting a lot less natural gas, which is what they use at that facility, out every time that door opens. They're going to retain heat in the maintenance area, which is not just preserving the energy, but also making it more comfortable for workers. They're going to be reducing the dispersion of engine fumes to other parts of the building, which is also better for the health of the people who are working in the building. And the city spends or budgets about $325,000 a year for this facility just for natural gas. And so if they have a 10% reduction, they'll save $32,500 in the first year. And it's not clear yet. They haven't been able to measure, because it's not done yet. But if they were to reduce it by 30%, and that's conceivable, they'd make a profit on this project. And it's a pretty low-hanging fruit, narrow project. Another thing that they've done as a part of implementing this is that they've installed solar thermal. They're kind of systematically installing solar thermal heating, water heating, at city fire stations. And they've gotten some grants from Focus on Energy and some other places to install that. Even on cold winter days so far, what they're seeing is that it heats the water up to about 100 degrees. So they're going to save the life of the boilers. They're also going to pay it off in terms of energy savings in a very short period of time. They've also, here's another kind of easy, low-hanging fruit project. They decided to convert, not in every single, but almost every single facility in the city's purview, to green cleaning products. And now they've expanded that to purchasing as well, so they're looking at office equipment, all of that. But this is one of those, another example of low-hanging fruit. This is pretty much a net, you know, it's across the board a wash in terms of cost. The green cleaning products do not cost anymore. They've had to do some education and change the way that custodial staff does the cleaning. But they've already had the mayor's already heard from a number of custodial staff saying thank you for this, because they have had asthma and skin conditions, and they've worked with it because this is a job they need. And since they've instituted this, which has only been in the last year or so, they're having fewer health problems. And so that's been, you know, that last principle is being met with something as simple as this. And this was something that came out of, it was initiated actually before the Natural Step training was over. It was initiated as a part of this process. The Monona Terrace Convention Center in Madison decided it was going to look at LEED certification and become a more green building. And what they did is, LEED is a national program of the U.S. Green Building Council that sets a benchmark for high-performance green buildings that are environmentally responsible and profitable and healthy places to live and work. And so Monona Terrace has been engaged in that process for a while, and so one of the things they were looking at was green cleaning and green purchasing. And so they said, we've already done a lot of the work, the groundwork. We've talked to companies and trainers on this. Johnson Diversey did the training. And so they helped the city expand it across agencies. On the green building front, buildings, commercial and residential buildings account for 36% of our total energy use, and about 65% of that is electricity consumption. They account for 38% of our greenhouse gas emissions, 30% of raw material use, 30% of materials landfilled, which is about 140 million tons annually, and about 12% of our potable water consumption. And so the issue of green building is rightfully a very popular issue right now, and communities are starting to look more and more at LEED and other certification. And you know, it's not a perfect tool, but it's one of those tools that tries to bring in those principles and satisfy those principles. And with the Monona Terrace building, they have achieved some pretty neat things. They earned LEED Silver certification, and it's only the third convention center in the country that has this level of certification. They're the first one to get certified as an existing building. In other words, they're already built, and they retrofitted for these green practices. And they're using, of course, the green cleaning products, which I already mentioned. They've also already seen a significant energy saving. They use 49% less energy than an average convention center uses across the country with comparable weather. They are using clean energy right now. They use 10% of their energy is renewable, and their goal is to get to 25% in 2008. Their recycling rates have shot up from 16% diversion from the landfill to 49% diversion from the waste stream, and they're looking at worm composting and other composting and other ways to divert from the waste cycle. And that's something that the city's also put on their list of things to do in their 2008 projects. There's something that our streets division guy is spearheading. It's called, Waste Watchers. And he wants to institute it within the city as well as the larger community. And it has everything to do with diverting from the waste stream, diverting and doing more recycling. And I think he just got back from San Francisco. He's out there looking at food composting systems. And it's also enhanced their marketability. It's a part of the Travel Green Wisconsin program. What they've seen and what I've experienced, because I've been to a number of these conventions there, they've had a huge uptick from doing this green building and it's kind of making this decision to go through this process. They've had a huge uptick in interest from conventions and organizations all over the country and outside of the country, international conventions that specifically choose the Monona Terrace now as their meeting place because of what it's done. So it's had an economic effect for them. And the Common Council has also passed a resolution requiring LEED for all new and remodeled buildings in the city starting July 2008. So we're going to see a lot more of this across building facilities. And I think that's a recognition of the huge energy use that city facilities create. And so just leave you with some key points. Communities that are showing leadership right now are investing in taking the leap off that iceberg and working on sustainability. And they're going to be in a better position for the challenges that we all understand we're going to have ahead. It's important to have a shared language, and you've already taken that step with your resolution. And I think the challenge will be to keep the momentum going by educating and bringing more and more of your staff, your agency people in outside, you know, the local, the formal government, but in the community, bringing them into that understanding so that you can work together. I just want to reiterate that the natural step is not just the principles, but it's also a process, trying to get outside of forecasting and really saying what is sustainability, what's success, and really working back from that. And then the process is evolving. It's not linear. You're going to make mistakes. Someone said to me the other day, sustainability isn't for wimps, and that's true. You know, it's really complex and it's frustrating. And I think in many cases, people feel like, we're piling this on top of everything else we have to do with the limited resources we have as local communities, as counties. How do we do this? And it's challenging, but I look at this as kind of a roadmap for doing that and for meeting that challenge. And then the details are up to you. And what's exciting is that the communities in Wisconsin are all implementing this in very different ways and are all seeing, you know, different results. But the goal is to move towards sustainability and to do it in a systematic way. And I'd be happy to take questions.
All right. Questions for Lisa? No questions for Lisa? She answered all your questions. Good.
Wow. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your coming. Jay, do I understand there's a meeting tomorrow of your... Is there a meeting tomorrow of your council? The joint committee? Tomorrow morning? Okay, sounds good.
I also just wanted to let you know that I mentioned the, Dr. Carl Henrik Robert's visit, that the Distinguished Lecture Series. There's also a sustainable business conference that the people up in Shawangunk Bay are putting on April 24th through the 26th, which is sponsored by the Alliance for Sustainability, and they'll be working with, they're inviting businesses and communities. And then there's also an international eco-municipality conference in Sweden in May. So if you're interested in learning more about any of these, feel free to contact me. I'd be happy to give you more information.
But no, the county board will not pay to go to Sweden. Sorry.
I'll leave that to you. Thank you.
Thank you for coming to La Crosse, Lisa. Next on the agenda, we have overview and status report on the development of the County Farm and Lakeview Business Park, and Steve will talk about this.
Just a couple of quick things to kick that off. Just to conclude, I wanted to make a couple of announcements that I didn't get done early on. For the future, in April, the policy planning meeting that's usually April 7th, during the organizational year where there's an election, you replace that with a retreat. So if you're doing your calendar, April 7th that night does not have a meeting like this. There will end up being a date set for the retreat, so you can take that off your agenda. Also, next Thursday night, for those of you particularly in the La Crosse School District, from 5 o'clock to about 5:30, there will be a presentation in this room by Jerry Kember and his staff on the referendum. You might have gotten an email or noticed that. Again, many of you might not be interested in that because you're outside the La Crosse School District, but if you are and haven't had a chance to come and see that presentation, that will be here. Last but not least, I actually have some handouts. Jeff Schrader was just here for a moment, and I'm sure he'll be back, but there is a Wisconsin County's Environment and Land Use Steering Committee meeting Friday. A couple of the items are on the Great Lakes Compact and the wind siting law. Ties into what we were just talking about, so I've got copies of that information. I know he's looking for other folks that might be interested in going. We're trying to see if some staff members can go. So if you're interested, I've got copies of that as well. The next agenda item that
wait a minute. Before we do that, Steve, sorry. Have you looked at any potential dates for the retreat?
No, I haven't. I thought we'd do that as part of our organization.
but if we're going to, we have the organizational meeting on April.
Would be April 15th.
15th, is that what it is?
Right. And we usually do it the week or two after.
Okay, but we need to set the date well before then so people can clear their calendars. So bring your calendar with you to County Board next week, so that that date can be set. If people can, Jim is trying to hand signal me.
No, sorry, Mr. Chair. I was wondering after these announcements, if we could just take a 2-minute stretch break before we get to the next agenda item. I think we'll all be fresher for that. Is that okay?
Sure, that sounds like a good idea. Marion, with the notice that goes out for County Board, can you put a note in there for people to bring their calendars? Let's take a break for a couple of minutes, come back, let's say 20 after, and we'll pick up at that point. Okay. Supervisors, please take your seats. Including the cheap seats in the back, please. Thank you. All right. Back to the agenda. We're up to number 3. Steve?
Just as a kickoff, we've got two brief presentations, and to give you some information is really an update status report on the development of the County Farm and Lakeview Business Park. Also, just as a segue, what's going to happen tomorrow or Wednesday at Executive Committee is a more detailed report on the actual tax increment financing plan and the actual status of that. Board members can have their own full copy of that that'll be available as you go out. So if you don't get a chance to attend the Executive Committee, but it gives you all the balance sheet and that kind of information. But the two things we want to accomplish is, number one, staff to give you an update on exactly where we're at and a quick review of the history and how we got to where we're at. And then the item number number 4 is going to be going into a presentation by Shriver Anderson talking about some of the choices about the long-term plan. And I think we think it's consistent with a lot of the sustainability issues we talked about controlling growth, about being able to focus some of our uses on a more sustainable land use and those types of things. So with that, I'm just going to turn it over to Charlie.
So we were assigned to do a PowerPoint presentation for you tonight. Guess who assigned that?
No.
And secondly, we wanted to make sure it was fancy and not just white with letters, so I gave it to Brian. So the quality of the presentation is because Brian did it. Little history on the county farm. Most of you know much of this. We've owned that county farm since the late 19th century. In fact, we've got some newspaper articles with the asylum building in, I believe it was 1887 in the photo. We purchased some additional acreage in 1960. We found the first apparent set of master planning in 1978. We have a copy of that in our office. In January 85, the Lakeview Study Committee was formed, and I see verbiage in there about Jan Kyle and Jeff Blusky going to the village board. So you get an idea of the scope and breadth of how long we've been working on this project. Subsequent plans were done in 94, 2002, 2004, and 2007, and each plan provided new and valuable information, and each previously adopted plan showed very similar land uses to what we're talking about, so we must be getting something right. Phase 1A of the business park is really where my link to this is. When I was hired in 2002, this was one of the initial projects that I was given. And so through the foresight and leadership of the county board, Steve Doyle, and at the current time it was called the La Crosse County Business Fund, the park officially kicked off in 03. We developed 40 acres initially, and a very creative partnership, as you see below. We had a great anchor tenant that helped us to build those successful partnerships, and the hard work of the county staff, especially the planning department.
We did it in spite of them? Is that it?
That's probably it. This gives you an idea of some of the tax base, square footage, jobs, et cetera, that has been built in that phase 1A. And then some photos. And then phase 1B, I'll hand it over to Brian.
All right, thanks, Charlie. I was actually hired at the very beginning of 2006 and started working on phase 1B of the Lakeview Business Park. Again, through the progressive leadership of the county board, the county administrator, and in partnership with the village.
You guys are just sucking up to everybody tonight.
Just stick around. We're not done. Phase 1B of the park kicked off in 2006. This was a very innovative project in relation to the state and locally as well. Through the hard work and lobbying efforts of some local officials and LADCO and organizations like that, state legislators actually changed the revenue sharing statute to allow counties to be a part of revenue sharing agreements. So we worked with the village because TIF counties do not have TIF authority. We worked with the village. The village used their TIF authority, and then through the revenue sharing agreement, they passed the increment along to us. As you all are aware. 40 plus acres, additional acres were developed. We had a great anchor tenant in River Steel. They brought in a considerable jobs creation as well as tax base creation, which we were able to roll into numerous grants. We had a great partnership again with the Village of West Salem. The DOT and the DOC were able to give us some grant funding, and then we also worked with the Regional Planning Commission to gain a federal grant from the Department of Commerce Economic Development Administration for that $819,000. I wanted to point out we had some great assistance from the City of La Crosse planning staff as well. Because we don't have any because a county has never had TIF authority, we didn't know how to put a TIF together. So we turned to our partners over at the city for some assistance with that, and they were very, very helpful as we put together this TIF project. Also working with Springstead with their extensive TIF knowledge and experience. So we also worked with the Joint Review Board that pulls together Western Technical College, the school district, the county, and the village, as well as a public member to actually take a look and approve this TIF. Through Phase 1B of the park, as I mentioned, we had a great anchor tenant in River Steel. They purchased 10.27 acres. Their current project, which they moved in at the end of 2007, was 55,232 square feet. They created 43 full-time jobs and are creating significant tax base out there. They also have a second phase, which will be completed by the end of 2009, of an additional 14,400 square feet. We're in the process of closing. We have a development agreement with Amherst. They'll be the main construction project out there in 2008. They're purchasing 15 acres and will construct 100,000 square feet, and we'll have 36 full-time jobs, and again, significant tax base creation out in that area. And again, more to come. The note on the bottom indicates there's approximately 16 acres out there that we're currently marketing, and then there could be more based on the master plan in the future phases of the business park. This is some photos of the River Steel construction as it was going on last year. The status report, as Steve mentioned, we did do a detailed analysis of the TIF. In the TIF project plan, it said we should do this annually, so we're trying to do that. Just keep an eye on how the TIF is performing, make sure it's moving along and progressing as we projected. I'll leave some copies over here so you can pick some up. As Steve mentioned, we'll be talking about that in more detail at the executive committee. Just a brief rundown of that is our expenses in 2006 and 07 were considerably lower than we projected. Due to a comprehensive reassessment of the village, however, the mill rate was considerably reduced, but our assessed values are considerably higher than what our conservative estimates were. So in summary, the TIF is performing really well, and we actually went through an amendment to the TIF in 2007, not because of poor planning, but because of success of the TIF. So we went through that amendment, and it was passed, and we added more area to the TIF and added more area so we can continue to develop out there. Other benefits the business park has brought, Sprint has moved into the former there was a vacant building just adjacent to the business park owned by Elmwood Partners that Sprint has moved into there. They've made significant improvements to that building and to that site, which is adding tax base to the village and the county. They've added over 100 new jobs and are in the process of adding approximately 200 jobs to that area. Village is also starting to see other development proposals in that area. And one key thing is we're really building a great partnership with the state as we do great, you know, good, successful projects around this area. The state is recognizing that, and consequently, we're able to leverage more grant funding. This is a real quick video. Just
the environment in West Salem from
some
a
of the business park. Business tenants out there,
which I think go hand in hand,
and we did not pay them to say this. So.
Really nice. It's a small community, has a simple kind of feel to it, yet it's progressive. There's a great educated workforce with Midwestern values, hardworking people, honest people. And so it has the simple values kind of the past with a mixed with a progressive look toward the future. So to me, it's a perfect balance.
The role that La Crosse County played, people like Charlie Handy, Steve Doyle, mainly in the early stages, were very critical to getting us in the Lakeview Industrial Park and getting us going and getting basically everything going. I'd also like to say that Jim Hill at LADCO was very instrumental in that process as well.
Charlie and Brian were very helpful. They opened a lot of doors for us, and they presented us with the vision for the park and the concept and brought us together with the village officials and just really facilitated things.
So as I said, they were not paid. That was they even paid full price for their land and still said that those things. But I just wanted to give you a flavor for we're really trying to build a nice cooperative environment out there, and we've been able to do that with our business partners as well. And that was just some clips of a DVD, a promotional DVD that we put together for the business park. So if you're interested, I can certainly get you a copy. As far as the future of the county farm, in 2007 we annexed the rest of the farm into the village in order to allow development to happen served by village utilities to allow for a denser, more efficient, greater tax base out there. We're currently working with Schreiber Anderson Associates to draft a master plan for the entire county farm. This master plan is designed to really include a mix of uses from industrial, commercial, mixed density residential, institutional, and a large percentage of green space. We wanted to introduce a new development style that's popular in other parts of the country and around the state, but hasn't really been introduced in this area in La Crosse County. So that's one responsibility that I think we have with this opportunity of the county farm, I think, is to try to introduce better development styles. And really, we want to focus on delivering a high quality of life for the residents of that area. Some of the estimates that we've projected are in the neighborhood of $200 million of tax base that could be generated on the county farm. We also did some analysis of some of the impact fees and things that could go towards the village, and this style of development would be significantly higher to help them finance their water utility needs and park development fees. As I said, this development introduces developmental densities that we haven't seen around this area. So I think this is kind of our responsibility to introduce new choices and good development practices into the market. It could meet some resistance, but through this density, we can create more efficiency in our delivery of services and therefore have a positive effect on tax rates. Just a quick insert on the future of economic development in La Crosse County. We certainly appreciate your support in supporting groundbreaking economic development efforts, and we really hope to kind of duplicate this in other areas of the county. We're working on a lot of proposals for other areas of the county to really partner with other local municipalities and try to do innovative economic development projects all over. With that, the next agenda item is a presentation by Kate Stalker from Schreiber Anderson Associates. As I said, they've developed three concept plans for the farm, and these concept plans are really designed to gather your input. So if we're ready to hand it off to Kate, we can move on to the next agenda item. And again, there's copies of the TIF report. I'll leave them over here if you want to pick one up on your way out. And again, we'll be talking about that at the
And the executive committee actually has this in their agenda packet, so you've already had it mailed to.
Chuck Spiker.
Could I ask a couple questions of Brian on the TIF? What is your projected closeout time of the TIF? Or do you have one?
The estimated the TIF was estimated to run about 13 years of actual tax increments, so we'll be looking to close it in approximately 2021.
If you filled up that TIF district faster than you projected, would that lower the closeout date of the TIF then?
Certainly.
Okay. Are you? Is this TIF going to be the last one up there, or just the first one of a?
That's really up to the village officials, but I think as far as...
Well, I mean, I'm talking about the second phase of this. Are we going to have a TIF for that too, or...?
Actually, the amendment to the TIF district included the second phase as well.
Okay. Thank you, Warren.
Sure.
Anybody have any other questions? Jim Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that it has the potential for $200 million in tax base potential.
Yes.
So I just quickly did the math here. So we're looking at about $6.5 million so far. So we're about we're not even 5% to our full potential then, right?
No. Yeah.
So we're just getting started. Correct. This is only about 3% of the $200 million.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah,
thank
I
you.
Think I mean a lot of the larger tax base is going to come in as one of the concepts that Kate will be talking about is the developmental densities of the residential area. Assuming we move forward with the type of residential densities that we're talking about in these concept plans, that's where a lot of the larger tax base is going to come in. We certainly want to provide a balanced tax base out there as well. And that's where the industrial park transitioning more into some commercial and office space, buffering that from the residential, and then moving into a more dense residential development, I think is where a lot of that tax base comes. But, you know, it's a large number, but it's a balanced tax base. So I think it's...
Thank you.
Just an observation, the fact that this place started out as a farm probably explains why it got so deep during Brian and Charlie's comments. So. Kate Stocker, let's hear what you have to say. Kate came in and did a lot of questioning of what we call the stakeholders involved in this process, both village, county, and elsewhere, and brought back some ideas to the Economic Development Fund. We talked about them at a couple meetings, including last week, to try to narrow down kind of not a plan that we wanted to recommend, but some ideas that we thought were important to be included in whatever plan comes forward out of the full board. And this is an issue that I feel very strongly should be a full board project rather than just one committee or a subcommittee or anything like that. And that's why we're here tonight at the full board level to talk about these different ideas that she's going to put forward, not asking for any decisions tonight by the board, but certainly looking for your input, your comments, your priorities that you think are important to accomplish out there. And so I'm assuming, Kate, that this can be a little bit interactive. If they have comments or questions while you're going, you're happy
feel
to...
Feel free.
All right.
Okay,
go
well, thank
it.
You. I'm happy to be here tonight, and I think it's fortuitous that I'm here after Lisa's spoken because I'm going to pick up right where she left off. Kind of deviate a little bit from the presentation I had planned and tell you that just this last week I've been lecturing at the UW Masters of Real Estate to several of their classes on sustainable development and on a particularly sustainable residential development and sustainable industrial development. So if you have any questions about that as well, I'd be happy to talk about that after I'm finished. I'm also the consultant the city hired to redevelop two blocks of the city, a blighted neighborhood called Allied Drive. You may have heard of it. And I've been working closely with the city that, and we've been working for months to try to determine the best ways to use the 11 apartment buildings that are currently on that site to recycle as much of the material as we can, reuse what we can on the site. And it really will be a model for the city of Madison on how to proceed with demolition. And that's all prior to construction, which we hope will be a green built home certified as a city development project. So I'm here to talk about the county farm, and I have to say when this came before us, we were thrilled to be a part of it, a project with so much history and so much a project that brings such a sense of community to everyone we've talked to. The history is just so incredibly rich, and whatever we do, we want to really honor that history. And I know there's been a lot of talk among the Economic Development Commission about affordability as well as sustainability, about making it a place for workforce housing for the entire county. a place that is sustainable, a place where you can live throughout your life and grow old and never have to leave the community. And that's the kind of sustainability I'm here to talk about today. More than the green belt and the things that Lisa was discussing, I want to talk about the social sustainability and what makes a sense of place and a sense of community. And on this rich site, we think what better place to lead the way in the county with a sustainable development. Oops, I've already gone too far. I'm sorry, Mary. Mary and I did not plan this, by the way. It's purely accidental that we're wearing all the same clothes. I wanted to start with, I know many of you are familiar with a traditional neighborhood development, but for those of you who aren't, I wanted to quickly try to run through the principles of TNDs, as we call them. And it encompasses all different building and zoning types, from commercial, residential, industrial, educational, civic uses, and all in close proximity with each other. And I'll go through the list quickly. It should have a discernible town center. You never want a residential unit more than a 5-minute walk from any commercial area. You need to have a variety of housing types. You want to encourage people to move into their first apartment in this neighborhood, get a condominium when they graduate from school, get their first job, get a small house when they get married, a bigger house when they have children, a condo when their children have left home, and move into senior housing as they continue to age without ever leaving the neighborhood. It creates a sustainable social neighborhood because you have a network of people of every generation that can all live in the same place. We want to have retail in that neighborhood to support the people who are living there so they don't have to get in their cars and continue down the road. It saves on the use of fossil fuels. It gets people out and exercising, keeps people healthy. We want kids to be able to bike to school. Schreiber Anderson's has the federal contract for the Safe Routes to School program. Some of you may be familiar with. We're implementing that in several communities this year in Wisconsin, and we intend in this project as well to use all of those same guidelines to design a neighborhood that is safe for children from every neighborhood to get to school. We also want kids outside playing, so it's important to have playgrounds distributed throughout the neighborhoods. Connectivity is very important. Connectivity with the existing town, with the village of West Salem, connected throughout the neighborhood so that people can have easy vehicular access, can have pedestrian access and bike access. We want to encourage alternate forms of transportation and certainly mass transit. As this community continues to grow, there will be opportunities right now that might be hard to envision for bus service, say, to La Crosse, but that day will come, and we want to plan everything now so that we've done the right things when that day does come. We like to have narrow streets and large parkways. We want to encourage people to drive slowly by reducing the pavement widths. We want a lot of trees, of course, because that shades the streets and shades the homes. We want to screen parking, and we want to preserve views. And certainly, as all of you know, this site has some incredible views. And I think perhaps living here, you may not appreciate them every day as much as I do or Lisa does when we drive up here, but it is just a beautiful place. And we want to make sure that everyone living in this development experiences that beautiful place every day by making sure that views continue to be unobstructed even as the site is developed in a dense way. This is an example of a traditional neighborhood, not your site, but it exemplifies all of the principles. We have the downtown. You can see sort of a town center, a square, commercial buildings around it. You can see office and industrial off to the right and residential off to the left with common park spaces in between. and I'm going to talk a little bit about density. This is the kind of density that you are accustomed to. This density we have determined to be unsustainable for many reasons. If a garbage truck is going to drive down one block and feed only four homes, it's using a lot of gasoline and man hours it doesn't need to use if you increase density. Another thing we've found with this type of more suburban development is that the rates of depression actually completely coincide with the numbers of strip malls and billboard signs one passes on the way to work. So we hope that with creating a type of community that's more dense with a downtown, we're actually improving the mental health of the people who live there. This is 4 units an acre, something you'd find on the outskirts of an existing city. And we get to 6 units an acre, and that was maybe just starting post-World War II. And we get to 8 units an acre. That's more like what you'd find in an existing downtown of any city in 1900. And that is now what we believe to be the most sustainable residential type of development. And this is for single family. Of course, density increases when you put in apartment buildings and such. So this is what that increased density looks like. Zoning codes that are written prior to the advent of the TND movement often say that the front yard setback for a building needs to be 30 feet, 40 feet from the street, and what you see when you drive down the street is a lot of garage doors. And with the TND movement, we say bring the houses back up to the street no more than 20 feet from the right-of-way. Put a front porch on every house, make the kind of neighborhoods that many of us grew up in where you know the neighbors and everybody's outside walking around and interacting with each other. Because when people interact with each other, they create a safe neighborhood, they reduce crime, and they know their children are safe to play outside, so they increase the health of the community. Here's another example, and I'm just going to kind of whip through these because I know you all know what I'm talking about. This is what some of the multifamily areas might look like, and now we've increased density even more than 8 units an acre. And here are lots of different examples of what that multifamily development can look like. Then we get to the town center. And in the plans that were done prior to our concept plans, there wasn't any commercial added to this area. And we said, oh, that's a mistake. People are going to want to get dry cleaning close to home, ice cream shop. If we have some sort of a town square, it's a nice place for people to gather. You might want to get a cup of coffee, a pizza. So we need to have some retail. And when we interviewed the stakeholders and we went to the Village of West Salem and met with the city staff, they said, yes, we'd love to have retail. I think the mayor's words were, there hasn't been a shoe sold on Main Street in 20 years. And we're competing with surrounding communities. We would love to have a retail area that could be successful. In order to make a retail area successful and sustainable, you need to have rooftops. So West Salem needs to grow in order to make that a viable option. Here's another commercial area. This is Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. They've just redone their downtown around a town square, and all the buildings around it new, made to look old. This is an example of a garden, a village garden, that would be something you'd see in a downtown, or a plaza with a fountain. Those are all typical things. Interesting streetscapes, because, again, you want to get people out walking, not driving, so you want to make it very pedestrian-friendly to move down the street with a lot of interest at human scale, at eye level, and a lot of benches. And, of course, a lot of bicycle parking. Something like this in a median gives you a place to walk, place to park the cars that's not right in front of the stores, making the sidewalks in front of the stores more pedestrian-friendly. But it also turns the median into somewhat of a park. Of course, we need all sorts of signage, places to pick up a newspaper. All of these things are components of a walkable community. Places to play are another component, and whether it's a fountain that can double as a splash play area or a community garden or a gazebo where you might gather with your friends or family or a farmer's market. All of these things work together to create an atmosphere of community. And now specifically talking about the property, you're all familiar with it, maybe not from this perspective. The gold dashed lines are ridge lines. The blue arrows represent the current flow of water off the site. The large blue egg-shaped area is the detention basin that exists to the east of the site. We've got, of course, the beige gold area that runs the length of it, and that represents the ridge line. In our site context map, the things that are important to note are that this property connects the township of Hamilton with the village of West Salem. It is bordered by the railroad and industrial park on one end and the lake on the other. You have economic resources on one side and natural resources on the other side. It gives us a great canvas to begin to work with. We also have the senior housing opportunity and the schools immediately adjacent to this property. It makes it an ideal location for a TND. We have three concept plans. They all have these principles I've outlined, and they're all three very different representations of how to accomplish that. In each of these, the colors are the same. They're colors that we traditionally use, and you'll find here that the dark purple down here is heavy industrial. This would be lighter industrial. The gold is office. The red is commercial. The green, and this is a hard green to read, is public open space. This blue is the existing county farm cemetery. Brown in here is townhomes and duplexes. That sort of thing. And then as you move out through the neighborhood, the lightest yellow is a larger lot, and the darkest yellow would be a smaller lot, more like the 8 units an acre. What we've done here, and I'm sorry if I'm not holding this steady, I don't want to make anybody sick, is that we've got a commercial area that's on the main street heading into West Salem. This would be the existing nursing home facility. These are the schools. And we said we want to have an easy access from the people who already live in West Salem to get to this new downtown. We also want to use this commercial area as a buffer between the industrial and the residential. There were some stakeholders we interviewed who felt very strongly that we should have more luxury residential on those bluffs to maximize the economic value of the project. So this concept shows fewer larger lots along the bluff property, but we've left views open. You can see right here, no, you can't see it. There you go. Right through here, we have a view that goes all the way out. And at the end of each of these roads, there is no housing. Same with, I keep losing the screen. There we go. At the ends of these roads, no houses. At the end of this road, no houses. And by doing that, we're preserving the views because those belong to everybody. The second concept plan does a little more to move the downtown closer to the existing village of West Salem, and in this concept, that downtown is fairly centrally located. If you consider the existing village and this new parcel, that puts the downtown smack in the middle of the village. What this does that the other one you've seen doesn't offer is that it allows for senior housing to expand and seniors to live immediately adjacent to the commercial area. And as I know from having a grandmother who was a shut-in, people who don't have access to get out and walk around and interact with people often love to sit in the window and watch things happen. And when you put a downtown next to a senior facility, it gives people the opportunity to feel like they're a part of things happening without actually getting down at street level. It also allows for people who can still be mobile but can't drive to get to the downtown and have an ice cream cone or sit out at a sidewalk cafe and meet people of different ages without having to get in a car to do that. And that's sustainable. I mean, that allows you to live your life fully even in the last years of your life. Oops, I did it again. I'm sorry, Mary, can you go back one? Thank you. In this concept, we have much less office and a much fewer of the luxury, what we would call the luxury lots, and we have a lot more of what we'd call the workforce housing. And in this area in here, with office, townhome, and townhomes and duplexes all around what may be a future sports facility complex, allows for kids with higher density houses to have access to a lot more of vast open space in which to play. And this is the green of a park here, which is difficult to see. But also, you'll see in this one, at the ends of these roads, we have the same view corridors open. In this concept, most of the traffic is running north and south through the neighborhood, but the main street existing in West Salem dead ends into this new downtown, and the new street that comes through connects up and easily provides access to school. With this concept, we hope that the vehicular access of people moving from township to village will stay on the main street, leaving the residential streets free of a lot of the vehicular traffic that you would see with some other plans. Now, this plan is based very closely on the plan that Vierbecker did for the county a few years ago that was approved and I think generally liked by most people. And so we wanted to bring that plan back again with very little variation to say, here's what that plan would look like if we added retail to the downtown. And it has many of the same benefits that the other plans have. An added benefit is a lot of open space between that downtown and the lake. And it has the least amount of luxury housing and the most amount of workforce housing. Each of these plans connects the industrial area. And, of course, if we want people to, as we say, live, work, and play in the same community, it's important for those businesses located in that industrial park to have workforce housing. It's important for the people who work there to be able to walk home and walk to work. It reduces the need for parking. It reduces the auto emissions. It's nice for those people in the industrial area to be able to walk somewhere where they can eat lunch at a restaurant or go to a bar after work. You have the ball fields to the east. It's great if people can walk from the ball fields after a game and go get a pizza in the downtown. So these are all the kinds of things that we've been looking at when we've been trying to orient the different uses and how they might work together. And that's the end of my presentation, and I'd be happy to take questions on anything you might have. Yes?
Leon.
Thank you. I was just wondering, how many residents did you plan on having in those? So you had three different concepts there. What did they vary? One through three or same number of residents?
They're all very similar in
number of residents.
In the economic value brought. You know, of course, the larger, the first plan with the more of the larger units has a lower density, and the middle plan, I think, has the highest density. But the economic value is fairly the same because you're going to get more money for the larger lots. And I guess it's a matter of the county's goals. Is the goal to create workforce housing? If the goal is to create a sustainable community, then you need workforce housing there. And and you need retail. And if the goal is to keep people in the community from moving out of the community, then you need to provide a variety of housing options so that people can stay there.
But the number itself, I mean, of residents, 500,000, 3,000, 1,000?
Oh, Charlie, before you leave.
What it's going to do.
You know, I can't read it on that screen up there. Do you?
We can provide that information for you.
You don't have any idea.
No, they. We all know. We know. We don't. I don't have it with me.
We've estimated.
Why don't you come up to the microphone, Brian?
And Charlie's going to run up and grab the big boards, and we're going to have those here. So when the meeting is over, you can look at them. And hopefully he'll get them down here while the meeting's still going on, that you refer to them if you have questions. Just be a little easier that way.
The estimates that we have would be for option one, it would be 1,089. Option two, 1,112. And option three, 981. Those are,
really,
I mean,
close.
Just based on, I mean, they're close.
So all around 1,000.
People.
People, and that's figuring average at 3.5 per house or 2.5?
Actually, Charlie put these estimates together, so I apologize, I don't have that number, but we can ask Charlie when he gets back.
Brad Paff, did I see your hand up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Three quick questions. Will the county be selling lakefront property in any of these plans?
In none of these plans does the county sell lakefront property, and I should have mentioned that we felt that in order to create a sustainable community, we needed everyone to have access to that open space. It's a wonderful natural resource for the entire community, not just this neighborhood. We would like to see it connected through with a bike path that would allow...
Dave, do you want to actually refer?
Sure. This one has a street through. This is the Vierbecker plan. I'm afraid I can't make this go back, but Mary, if you can go back two more. That road you see on that plan is the road that's in there now,
right,
and it's just connected up the other side. If we talk about bike routes only, we don't want children riding bikes through that park going to school. That is not safe. We want the children out where people can see them, where there are a lot of eyes on the bike path. But if a family wants to go for a bike ride on a Saturday afternoon, that is the ideal ideal bike or pedestrian connection to the existing village from the township, and we think it's important that everybody has the opportunity to take advantage of it.
Well, that leads into my second question. You had mentioned earlier in your presentation narrow streets, and I had spoken to the mayor of the city I live in, City of Onalaska, and I spoke with him about narrow streets at one time, and he was somewhat concerned regarding public safety, police, fire, and EMT getting down these streets.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked for your response on that.
That's a common concern. And there are turning radii of large trucks, especially an aerial ladder fire truck, which is the most difficult vehicle to turn. And we have to use those templates when we create any sort of street design. And the streets I'm working on right now in the sustainable community in Madison have 10-foot drive lanes, two 10-foot drive lanes, and if there is parking, it's 8 feet wide. That is extraordinarily narrow, and it forces people to drive more slowly, and that increases safety and reduces accidents. And if there is an accident, it's not as serious an accident. We find that, and there are many studies, which I would refer you to, that show that the wider a street is, the faster people go psychologically. It doesn't matter what the speed limit is. You think you have an unobstructed view, you move more quickly. It is not safe for children, families, people who are out in the street or crossing the street. Additionally, we decrease the width of the street, and then we also bump out the curbs. And I wish I had an example of what that looks like. But we make the street extra narrow at intersections, and then we we widen it where we want cars to park, and we narrow it back up where we don't. And in that way, we leave areas for snow removal. And in years like this, everyone's very sensitive about that. And we also prevent any car from parking near an intersection so that we know that it's very safe for pedestrians crossing and they have good visibility.
Kate, can I interrupt you and have an unplanned diversion here for a second, because the Onalaska City Planner is here.
Sure.
Jason, Jason, can you talk about what you've done on Main Street and the bump out idea and all those other things and address Brad's comments? Because that might be something that people have actually seen and can understand rather than the theoretical.
Mm-hmm. In Onalaska, we have the curb knockouts at the corners on Main Street. Those were put in 2000, and they seem to work well for traffic calming. It is a known fact that people will drive faster on a wider cross-section. I think there is some trade-off as far as emergency access goes. There's no doubt about it. I've had long discussions with our police and fire people, and when you have parking on a narrow street both sides, it's a little bit more difficult to get in with a big fire apparatus or something like that. It's just so you have to weigh the trade-offs.
Thank you, Jason, for your
Thanks,
comments,
Jason.
Because I have talked to the mayor as well on that. And just real quickly, I like the plan. I just want to ask you, how can we ensure that we can have business success, these small novelty business success in these little community roundabouts or whatever we want to call them. I mean, all of us want the that type of community setting, but are we going to have to work together in order to find the right businesses and provide the right incentives for a mom and pop shop, maybe a pizza shop or a pizza or an ice cream shop or whatever it may be, in order to locate? Because otherwise it's so terribly difficult in order to ensure success.
Right, you're right. You can't ever ensure success. What you can do, in lieu of having a market analysis that tells you what the ratio is of housing to businesses and stores, is to, and this is how I would start, interview people who work in the industrial park and say, where would you like to shop? Where would you like to live? What kind of a house would you like to live in? If we provided these things in close proximity, would you move here? And I think you'd probably get your best answers that way.
Right. Thank you very much.
Other questions people have of Kate? Margaret?
Could you just give us a landmark so I really know what I'm looking at?
Yes.
I mean, I'd be happy to. Show me where Linda's Bakery is, but that would help.
It would be over here. This is the school complex. This is the property that the county just sold to the village. This is the boat launch. And this is the town of Hamilton. This is the town line. Does that help you?
And Charlie's house is right there on the right?
And Charlie's house is right here.
Okay, now we all know. Other questions? Ray.
Yeah, I'm just interested in the concept of another downtown. The current downtown, there's 4,000, 4,500 residents, and it's not doing extremely well. How are we going to support two downtowns?
That's a good question. In speaking with the officials, the mayor and the fire chief and the police chief, et cetera, of the Salem, they think they just have a couple of bars and some municipal uses and maybe a barber shop, and they would really like to see a downtown that thrives. There are a lot of people in the Salem to support businesses now. Additionally, Alaska seems to be the place where people want to go to shop. And they're not going to change that. People are still going to continue to go to Onalaska to shop because they're going to have stores there that West Salem is not going to have for 50 years. But West Salem can have things that make life in West Salem more convenient. They just need more people in order to support those. And then they need people who are willing to step up and say, I want to support these things. I believe in this kind of a community, and I want to live in a community like this. I think a lot of it now is just sheer numbers. There just aren't enough people.
But isn't it also people who work there and not just sleep there?
That's true, too. You need people there. There
Salem, correct?
Mm-hmm.
We obviously have to take the lead in developing our land. We have a lot at stake. I guess my question is, what is the role of the Village of West Salem in this? Because it seems like it's a county that developed. Are we going to develop their village? I mean, this is going to be the Village of West Salem. Well, this is going to be in the township. He's like first, and then Charlie. Map to then make some adjustments to
home is 19.6 acres. There's 118 acres of green space, an acre and a half for the cemetery, and then about 52 acres set aside for road right-of-way. So
we have a chart that you guys did that have a comparison of proportions that people can look at. You know, again, we're not doing decisions tonight, but... Well, that's a discussion we've had, Jim, and let me have Brian and Charlie talk about the discussion and the studies we've done in terms of the mixes, because we had talked about, does residential make sense at all? We learned some things that we did not know before we started that discussion. The concept, and as Kate talked about, is really to try to use some other uses to try to buffer that industry from the residential. As you transition up towards the lake, you start with the rail served industrial, then you end up with lighter industrial businesses such as Identity Works and Frito-Lay, which are more distribution-type facilities. Then you transition, you know, into some more office-type uses. And then into that commercial retail area, and then into some more denser housing with some townhomes or multifamily housing, and then you get into the density of the housing decreases a little bit as you get towards the lake, and then you end up with the tremendous natural resource of the lake. It's also not coincidental that we've started with the industrial first. That will be there before the houses get built, so that if you want to build a house there, you already know what your neighbors are going to be. Well, they're not going to pick out these industries that are already there. Right. But that's why we're doing it in that particular order. Right?
Yes, sir. Brian, if you don't supervise your answer to a survey, it was not a scientific survey. We got 175 answers. Somewhere between 2/3 and 75% of the people who answered wanted more industrial and less residential in that area. So, and I believe that the village did something beforehand that kind of matched that. I'm just wondering if we're trying to put our take or whatever on the village, where I think they feel that there's a lot of places to build homes in the village and in Hamilton. And there's so few places with that type of an industrial setup. And I'm just wondering if we're not really going by what those people want.
I think we're definitely going by what those people want. I think, you know, there's certainly a considerable portion of the county farm that's being developed in industrial development, and it's adding significant jobs. When we start talking about a balanced tax base and we start talking about this project is very unique, and it's a tremendous opportunity for many respects. But we start talking about the assets of this property, and they're unmatched. I mean, you look at you have the rail. So yes, you need the rail served industrial. This is one of the few opportunities for that on the south side, and then you have the lake on the north side, which is a tremendous resource for all uses, but primarily for residential use. I mean, when you start looking at that as a resource and an asset to residential use, and that's what these plans really try to achieve, is a good balance of both a significant portion of industrial land and significant job growth in the village of West Salem, which I think is what the people are asking for. Is, I mean, when you start looking at the number of jobs and we're not even nearly half done with the industrial park, and there's already been and if you look at the Elmwood parcel that's adjacent to our business park, I mean, there's been significant job growth out there. I mean, in the neighborhood of almost 300 new jobs already, and we're not even close to being half done with the development out there. So I think we're creating significant industrial development. We're creating significant jobs. Now we really need some place for those people who are working there to eat and shop and live. And that's kind of where the rest of that development comes to.
What we're not planning to build, by the way, is a traditional subdivision. I mean, you can get those anywhere in the county, and so we're really staying away from that type of an arrangement. Ralph?
In regards to who was there first or who's going to be there first, the Lakeview Healthcare Center was there first, and I think the Board of Trustees ought to take a position on which plan they like the best, which would be the most compatible with their operation. So somewhere down the line, I think the trustees ought to look at these plans, and if they got any objections or they like one better than the other two, we should know that.
Sure. Sure. We get some input from them. Jill?
Maybe this is a question for Charlie. Do we know how many lots? We've talked about how many lots are in the county that are waiting for development. Do we know how many in West Salem?
Statistically, yes, off the top of my head, no. In the office, I have those numbers, but I don't know that answer right off the top of my head. Like you said, we know we have about 1,200 in the county that are vacant. We have the Lewis Farm that was recently developed, which has 134 lots, I believe, in it. And of those 134, I'm guessing they're about 30% full. There's the subdivision that was developed along the La Crosse River. I think that's 17 lots, Terry, is that right? And there's only one house in there. Those are within the village, and obviously there's a few scattered lots in older developments that are vacant, but there are a number of vacant conventional lots in the towns of Hamilton, Greenfield, Bangor surrounding this. So I don't know that number off the top of my head, but there's definitely a number.
Well, I ask because I see that this is an incredible asset, and I'm wondering with the housing market now, why are we looking at developing this now rather than just letting it wait for 50 years?
Well, I don't think that the answer is we're looking at developing it now. I think the answer is we're looking at getting the plans done, getting them right. And then finding out what's the best time frame for developing it, just like we're doing in the industrial park. You know, we're not taking off 160-acre chunks of industrial. We're taking off 40-acre chunks at a time. And so I think what we'll do is if we get these plans assembled with the approvals and the consensus that we're trying to build, then we find out when's the right time to develop this 20-acre chunk or that 10-acre chunk, and really do it right as we go, understanding the market forces and trying very hard not to compete, you know, not to be a detriment to the market, and then also doing it right so that it can be transit-oriented development, that it can be walkable and bikeable and et cetera. So it's really getting the plan set, building the machine, and then when we put the gas into the machine, which is the old adage, maybe now we put switchgrass into the machine or whatever, but that's we have to decide when that's the right time to do that.
Steve?
The other piece to remember is as we're gauging where the market is at for a high-density level of development, remember the study that Carl Green did about cost of community services? Low-density housing doesn't pay for itself even next to villages. High-density housing does. And high-density housing in this area will actually generate more taxes as a comprehensive part of development than just doing all of it in industrial. So we'll have to be gauging this over time as a policymaking board. When is the right time for this? And how do you do it in pieces that generates the most tax base? And we've actually run numbers on all that, and we'll provide that to you. Contrasting, if it was all industrial or commercial, how limited that would be in actually generating tax base, whereas high-density residential actually changes the economics of what Carl was talking about in the cost of community services. So you'll have that kind of information as we make these decisions.
Ray?
Yeah, I think that maybe when you're talking about this being developed in 20 years, I think that before this concept is going to be palatable to at least the people that live there now, that it might be 10 or 15 years when, again, gas becomes $7 or $8. But I think on the short term, this is not you know, particularly, but maybe in 10 or 15 years.
Terry?
Thank you, Steve. I just want to make a couple comments, and these are just comments from a guy that's been around that county farm for most of his life, and I think I was in on every one of them plans that they had up there. And I want to refer to what Ray said. In all the years that we worked on that to get some development out there, which was industrial development, in all the reading I've ever done and looked at development, is that if you look at La Crosse County as a whole, maybe I should go that route. What we want to do is we want to put industrial development really by places where you can service them with sewer and water connections, municipal sewer and water connections. Now, La Crosse County is overrun right now with residential development. And in our survey, people really wanted, if you look at the line up there, Garland Street Extended was what we asked the question of, should we go north of Garland Street Extended? And that's where that about 75% of the people said, yes, we should go north. As long as we got industrial development going there. And I know that the DOC, after I worked with them for a lot of years on this farm, they've always said that this is the greatest place along the ice system to do a development, to do a industrial development. And I think that if you set these plans down like now and say, we're going to limit to what we're going to do out there, I think you really are going to limit it. Because this is kind of we've always considered this kind of a moving, going thing. And right now, West Elm has got a lot of lots. They got a lot of lots. There's a lot of talk already now about doing that corridor between Nathan Hill and the village of West Elm, filling that up with lots. There's lots being proposed out on County M, which is just south of the village of West Elm. And when you talk about, you know, tax base with more dense development, which I believe in. I believe in skinny streets. I believe in more dense developments. I believe in all of this stuff because of I've done a lot of reading and studying on it. But, you know, there are some other factors when you say it's going to bring more tax bases. It's also going to bring a lot more expenses to it because as the people move in here and the children, we're going to have more schools. And the expenses mount pretty rapidly when you talk about that. And, you know, you can look at what happened to Holman when they did a lot of that development over there. So, you know, to the village itself, you're going to create a lot more expenses. Is it right or is it going to pay for itself? I don't know. But like I said, and I'm going to make one comment on the downtown. There was something there that made me throw my pen because when they say there ain't enough people in West Elm to support a downtown, you know, I think when you do developments, you have to look at the history of what happens in history. You know, I believe in traditional neighborhoods because the village of West Salem, when it was originally built, was built as a traditional neighborhood. That's how most communities in the state of Wisconsin were built. They were built as traditional neighborhoods. There was commercial, and then they built houses around them, and people walked to where they worked at. The commercial flourished, the villages flourished, but they were traditional neighborhoods in the true sense, and they really worked fine. Well, in West Salem, unfortunately, when they put the I system in and they put Highway 16 and widened that out, and then somebody put a mall out here, kind of finished the end of downtown West Salem. And, you know, we had 1,100 people in West Salem when I was a kid, and we had, I think, 5 grocery stores, and we had 3 men's or clothing stores, and we had 4 or 5 restaurants, and we had shoe repair places, we had shoe selling places. I mean, we had a flourishing downtown, and it slowly has dissolved as a pop. Now we've got almost 5,000 people in West Salem. We can't even support anything in our downtown. So, you know, you look at the history of this, and it has a lot to do with the mall. It really does. I mean, and when somebody says they haven't bought a shoe in downtown West Salem in 20 years, well, part of that problem is people quit buying pairs of shoes in downtown West Salem and went to the mall to buy shoes. And that's what happened to it. I mean, it's reality, so I think some of these plans you really got to look at. You got to look at a sense of history, and you got to look at what that land out there and what industrial and job growth we want in La Crosse County is against just more and more residential growth in West Salem. And I'll shut up.
Other comments? Thank you, Terry. Other comments or questions of Kate? Since we've got her here tonight, Jeff, did you have a question or comment?
Not of Kate.
That's okay.
Now, you say you're going to be discussing this in the executive committee later on this week?
No.
The executive committee is talking about the TIF plan. It's just an updated financial report. The next stage with this will be continued work with input from the village board and from the business fund and bringing back more recommendations to the full county board. Now, Wednesday's executive committee is only on the TIF financials, just to have the executive committee up to date on that. And you all are welcome to copies of it as well.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Kate, have anything else to add? Did we cover everything that you needed?
Yes, I think we did, but Charlie and Brian have my email address if you have a question later you didn't think of now.
All right, I think that gets us to the end of the agenda. Other than future agenda items, anybody have any? Andrea.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know this has created some issues and questions for people, but I had asked Mr. O'Malley when Lori Urey came from Marathon County to give that presentation to some of the county board members that were there. I felt that some of the questions and answers that were given were really important, and I think that I feel the whole county board should hear the presentation that Lori Urey came to La Crosse to give, and I would like to know if it's possible for Lori Urey, that is in charge of the Justice Sanctions Program for Marathon County, to come back to the Policy Planning Board to give that presentation. You know, I just feel that possibly there's some cost savings there by outsourcing some of the items that Justice Sanctions does, and I feel that I would like to get that opportunity to have her back here to give a presentation. You know, if we spent an hour and a half tonight on sustainability, and I thought that was very important, but I also feel very strongly that I would like to see her back and give that presentation. You know, maybe there is no cost savings, but, you know, have we really proven that there isn't going to be any cost savings if we do some outsourcing with drug testing, urine testing, and so on? You know, I would like to see her here.
We had a joint committee meeting between Judiciary and Law and Health and Human Services 2-3 weeks ago on exactly that topic.
Did you have her here?
Not her, but that was the reason for the joint meeting, to look at whether there could be more contracting out. I mean, that was discussed, and unfortunately hardly anybody other than the committee members showed up to that meeting. But I mean, that was exactly the reason why they met.
But well, I'd like to make a motion to have that person from Marathon County to come to La Crosse and give a presentation to the whole county board. I think everybody should hear her presentation and just kind of give the pros and cons as, is there some cost savings by outsourcing to Attic Corrections or whatever, you know, business, I guess, that we decide to, if we would decide to do that. You know, I'd like to see that.
Does anybody know what she charged? I don't know.
I thought it was $150. Yeah,
she charged mileage, is my understanding. We'd love to, as county staff, actually have the opportunity to present both sides of all the issue, which, as you know, mm-hmm. that presentation was very controlled. There was no ability for us to respond to anything, and I'll compare our record to Marathon County or any other county in the state on how much we contract out, what results we produce, and I'd love to have that discussion. We had it at the Judiciary and Law and Health and Human Services. I'll leave it up to the board members how we respond, but that was so controlled, there was no opportunity for the county to give our point of view, and you can evaluate whatever the data is there, mm-hmm. but there was no opportunity for us to give any input.
And I did feel that it probably shouldn't have even been presented there. It should have been presented before the whole county board. I am not a member of CRG. I just thought it was a very good presentation, and I think the whole county board should at least listen to if there is a opportunity to save some money, and that's all I am requesting. Thank you.
What's the consensus of the board? Would you like to have her come? And
I'll second her motion.
Okay. Well, let me just do it this way. Anybody have any problem with having her come? Jill has a problem with having her come.
I'd just like to make a statement just to make sure that correct information is out there. And you'll all get this in with your packet, I believe. On our joint meeting, we learned that 36% of Justice Sanctions budgets for contracted services that include electronic monitoring, drug testing, and most recently the Women's Community-Based Program, and that 50% of Human Services has contracts for 50% of its total budget. Just so that information's out there, and I would welcome the opportunity to study this.
Okay, we'll get her in here. Steve and I will take a look at what the upcoming months have scheduled already, and we'll try to get her in here in the next 3-4 months or whenever we have an opening. But I'll tell you, my intention would be that it would be a balanced type of thing, not just one size fits all.
Because Marathon County is a little bit different, being that, you know, they have combined services for their park department with Wausau and Marathon County, and for some of their police patrols as well. So.
Sure.
And,
okay.
And their total tax levy is about double ours, just by the way.
Got to remember, combined services. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody have any other items for future agendas or announcements that you want to make? Terry Hansen. Moved to adjourn by Terry Hansen, seconded by Don Meyer. All in favor say aye. Opposed no. Carried unanimously.